From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. We have a very special guest on today's program. Michael Mennert was one of the first artists to be added to Derek Vincent Smith's Pretty Lights music roster. That makes sense since the two came up together in the Colorado music scene and started producing hip-hop as buddies in high school. Mennert's experienced a ton of ups and downs since that time, and he's going to tell us all about it. On top of that, we get to hear never-before-heard previews of some of the tracks that are coming out on his whopping 20-plus track album, Even If It Isn't Right, which drops April 24th on PLM. Today's show is brought to you by Euphonic Conceptions, presenting Bicycle Day on April 19th at 1015 Folsom in San Francisco. This is the official pre-party for Symbiosis and features artistry from Alex and Allison Gray, visuals from Jonathan Singer, and music from my guest, Michael Mennert, along with a ton of other artists, on the web at ecpresents.com. Okay, let's get to the interview. First off, tell me about Denver this past weekend. You got to unveil the big new stage show. I bet that was a thrill.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I've been waiting to kind of have the stage that I wanted for a while. You know, like you tour and as you kind of wait till you have like an opportunity to bring out the big gun, so to speak. And a radio edit who did Derek's stage and who did the content for Big Gigantic's new stage. They've been friends of mine since before they worked with those guys, and it's kind of like waiting for the day that I can afford to venture with them. So it was months of work and years of playing kind of coming together into one night of just more than I expected.
Did you sketch out an idea on a napkin? Did they come to you and say, you know, this is what your music looks like to us? Were you integral in the design of it, or did you say, you know, you guys are pros, you have fun with it?
Even before Melvin came out, we were looking at a bunch of like stuff that they were doing in Europe with building mapping and stuff like that with projectors, and we realized how easy it was with just the programs to map surfaces. I mean, 2 years ago when Dave was on tour with me, we had a projector in my house, and he'd be like mapping stuff to my fridge, you know? So, and just like showing me how easy it was to kind of like have these different surfaces to work with. And we wanted to do something that kind of harks back to my roots in Colorado. We wanted to have kind of like a mountain, rigid mountain skyline with the sun behind it, you know, as the basic shape. And I had no idea what it was going to be as a final product. We just kind of wanted to have it be something that was organic and yet had like kind of a spacey feel.
Absolutely.
So yeah, we basically like he fishing out some stuff and he had shown me some things that he'd been doing because in the meantime their office in Chicago, they've been kind of projecting things on like little miniature dioramas of what stages could be, you know?
Yeah.
So he showed me some like the pyramid, the triangle stuff he had going in. We decided we're going to go with like a symmetrical, you know, pyramid-driven base that kind of looks like a mountain range and also looks kind of like the surface of the moon or something like that. I think it worked out really well. I mean, it came together with something that isn't just, you know, to look at it and say, oh, that's just the Colorado skyline, you know, but it also has like that element where it can be that. And we just unveiled it, and we're going to be bringing it out a few times between now and the fall tour when I'm going to take it on tour the whole time, but we're still building a bunch of content for it right now. It was just kind of like, you know, Saturday was like a cross our fingers and hope it works type of test run, so.
The reason I ask is because everyone in the PLM family, it seems you're all just very hands-on, doing your own thing and yeah, moving your own direction. You know, where the rest of the country, it goes beyond the visuals and the sound, too. You know, it seems like where the rest of the country has been just obsessed with super commercial, slickly produced dubstep, you and your crew have been cultivating this very different vibe in Colorado. I like to call it mountain music. I hope it catches on. But it's very centered on hip-hop and crate digging. Is there a conscious effort at the label to stay away from the mainstream, take on bass music, or are all you just not into it like that?
I just think that, like, you know, just like anything else, I mean, me and Derek started making music a long time ago, basically because we go into record stores and that wasn't what we wanted to hear, you know? We go there and we'd be like, man, I like parts of like this kind of music, parts of this kind of music, but there really isn't anybody doing it the way we want to see it, you know? And it's like, the utmost respect for every type of electronic music, even if I don't like it, you know? And I respect it for what it does, it all pushes the whole genre as a whole, you know, and the whole movement forward, but I just think that there's so much of that bass-heavy, polished, poppy dubstep out there that it's like, why have a crew that doesn't need to do that? You know, we don't need to make commercial records. We're playing shows to make our money, you know? Like, we don't make money off of selling commercial songs or jingles, you know? Like, we give our albums away for free so that we have the freedom to do what we want with our music and not have people try to guide us commercially, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's kind of like, in a world where it's such a competition where everybody's trying to make the bigger drops, the bigger bass sound, it's why even participate in that, you know? It's like Gandhi said, the best form of rebellion is non-participation in things you don't believe in.
Yeah.
It's like rather than sitting there and trying to race with everybody and trying to make the biggest lines and the biggest bass drops and, you know, the poppiest stuff and just the catchiest tunes, it's like, I want to make music. You know, at the end of the day, it's like, I got into music because of what music got, you know, put into me. And that's just like this fire, like this desire to want to see a world the way that you want it to be. You know, it's a drug in itself, you know, it's like seeing kind of it's fuel for imagination. And that's what I want to do, you know, and like really like, not that the other music isn't imaginative, but to me it just doesn't stir me the same way that, like, you know, music that has more bass around feeling and kind of imaginative approaches to it has, as opposed to just having heavy computery sounding stuff, you know?
Sure. Do you think you'll ever move away from the crate digging model? I mean, granted, if you spent all day just listening and sampling, you couldn't make your way through 1% of all the stuff that's out there. But is it still your go-to method for becoming inspired?
Well, no, I mean, that's the whole thing is, like, you know, like, I mean, growing up, I was in band. I was playing keys and samplers and vocal and doing, like, vocals, whether it's hip-hop or something, like, in groups, you know, and playing guitars and stuff and doing stuff in the studio. And it's like, I just love the crate digging aesthetic because you find these little gems of things. But I mean, even in the set I did on Saturday, I played like 5 or 6 songs and didn't have a single sample, you know? But I feel like they were infused with the same elements that I like out of music that I can recreate. It's just, you know, I mean, if I could afford to be where some people are, where they can, you know, go in the studio and have well-trained musicians that play lines, you know, it's like, I could do that. But right now, it's like, I can't have a symphony do what I want to orchestrate. So it's like, I have to kind of use samples and whatnot to create what I imagine for music. And on top of that, like right now, I'm working on an EP after the set, because I'm dropping a really long LP that's like an hour and 41 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
But after that, I'm planning to do like an EP that's already almost in the can, and it's completely sample free. It's kind of like a futuristic, post-apocalyptic vision, a lot more synth-based, but still warm and kind of analog, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, I'd like to have my foot on the line with that in regards to that. But it's like right now, it's just being somebody that, you know, digs for records everywhere I go, and it's just, I mean, it's something that I just get excited about. You know, it's like Christmas every time I go into a record store and you find some old, like, jazz record you never heard of, or some old funk record, or some psychedelic rock record from the late 50s, early 60s or something. You know, it's like you find some stuff that just makes you want to see what's in there, you know, and you find those moments that, like, were not used to their full potential in terms of what they could be done with now, you know?
Yeah.
Or what could be done with them now. And so, I don't know, I always loved that about, like, hip-hop and the crate digger aesthetic. It's just that you could take any kind of music, you know? It was really, like, the first time music was universal to me is when I grew up listening to hip-hop and seeing that, like, they could take a classical loop or, you know, even a country song and make it into a hip-hop song. And it was just, like, the possibilities were endless, and people were using different time signatures. You could have stuff in 3-3 or 6-4 or, you know, 5-4. I mean, all kinds of people were experimenting with, like, weird underground hip-hop at the time. And though a lot of it didn't pan out, a lot of it did plant seeds in mind to people like myself who wanted to see it kind of reach its potential.
You're listening to brand new Michael Mennert tracks right here on the UNTS Podcast.
You've mentioned that you came up in the game with Derek, but I want to talk about your early years. You're originally from Poland, but your family emigrated early on. I'm wondering if you were maybe motivated by the politics of your youth. Were you aware of Lech Walesa and Solidarity, or were you too young for that? I'm just trying to get a sense for what motivates you.
I mean, it was actually funny because my parents, you know, like my dad was part of the Solidarity movement. He was like translating banned books and passing out leaflets, and a lot of his friends were even deeper in it than he was. Him being an English professor in Poland allowed him to kind of have access to books and things that normal people didn't, you know?
Sure.
So I think that, like, growing up, you know, he and my mother talked about stuff openly around me, and I kind of soaked up more than they thought I did. You know, they say that kids listen a lot more than you think they do.
Sure.
And I remember, like, when we were trying to get our visas to escape, we had vacation visas to flee to the next country over, Germany, at the time, and they were talking in the car, and I was just kind of like, I just kind of chimed in from the back, and was like, how are we going to escape if we don't get our visas? And I think I was, like, 3.5 years old at the time, you know? And
oh, jeez.
Had no idea that I was so aware of, like, the plight and, like, the, you know, the struggle of what was going on. But I think it did, in a way. I mean, and I think that just seeing how dedicated my dad was to his music collection then, and how much, like, he went over to England to, like, get books and vinyl and stuff like that as an excuse to kind of, like, you know, work on his language, and he'd go out there and work and bring some money back to the family every summer. I think that just seeing how much into him and looking up to him my whole life, and also just kind of, you know, coming here as now that was kind of in between cultures, I feel like a lot of my time was spent in my own head, and, you know, and in that I found a lot of refuge in my music collection early on, you know, and a lot of stuff that my dad turned me on to, and a lot of, like, Polish records that I heard around the house, because I didn't have any brothers or sisters, you know, they were older than me, they kind of, like, knew it was up in high school. It was just, like, yeah, I had friends and stuff like that, but for the most part, the music that I heard around the house before, you know, before YouTube was somewhere you could go and just Google whatever you want to listen to, mm-hmm. Like, I'd hear a bunch of obscure stuff that my dad had, and a bunch of old Polish, like, rock bands, and, like, you know, synthesizer music and stuff like that from the 70s and 80s, and like that had a huge part of my musical development, whether or not it was intentional, whether or not it was my own musical taste, it just kind of rubbed off on me, you know? It's kind of how, like, a lot of, like, the crate diggers, like, grew up with their parents listening to soul records, you know?
Absolutely.
Became this imprint on their own kind of signature on their music, so...
Yeah, I'm trying to get a sense for, you know, obviously you were sonically influenced by these varied influences and your background early on. Do you feel, because you have such a platform, that it's your responsibility to sort of carry that torch where your folks left off and continue, you know, conveying a sort of broader message than maybe, you know, this is party music? Because it seems like this isn't party music. What you and your colleagues are doing, there's something more. It's either deeply spiritual, or it's more motivated by real life shit, basically, and not just get drunk, bang your head, and you know, forget about it the next day.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, it's kind of like the whole thing of, you know, our whole generation is kind of this misplaced generation of people that, you know that we're going to be bankrupt by the time we're, you know, in our 30s and 40s, and have run into credit card debt in our late teens and things like that, you know, and just, like, have gone to college. A lot of people have gone to college and can't get jobs in the field that they want, and a lot of us will watch our parents who worked for, you know, 20, 30 years for a company get laid off or not losing their recession, you know? And so, like, a lot of the hopes and dreams and constants of American life and of just, you know, life on Earth that we took for granted are just being pulled away slowly. And I feel like that's why the rise of party music has been so huge, is because it's escapism. You know, it's a way for people to kind of be like, well, fuck it, I only have $20, but that's gonna be enough to have a kick-ass show this weekend and lose my mind and forget about it for a few days. You know, and, like, that's cool, and I'm not bashing that at all. But I think that, like, in that moment, if we kind of have a feeling of being united and a feeling of kind of belonging to something more than just a party and more than just an excuse to get wasted, you know, it's like, I feel like we could actually do something as a generation and as, you know, a species. And I mean, maybe that's a little bit too ambitious, and I'm not trying to say that I'm trying to be some cult leader or anything like that. I'm just saying that, like, just being aware of, like, you know, like, the first time that you, I mean, that's what music is, you know, like, the first time you hear it, you feel like you're connected to somebody you've never met before, you know, like, you feel like you understand, like, the hurt or the love that they feel through their music, and it makes you feel a little bit less alone in the world. And it's like, to me being an only child and me having, you know, like, just like anybody else, having times of doubt and depression, it's like music helped me get through that. And if I can consciously like step in that direction and be aware of that while I'm making it, rather than just trying to make a soundtrack of somebody's weekend, then I feel like there's something more that can be gotten out of it, you know? And it might make people care more about their own lives and care more about like the impact that they have on other people, you know? Because it's just like when you get to a certain point and people start telling you that like your music really like moved them in certain ways, or just, you know, like was there for them on a day where they felt like nothing else was, it puts a sort of responsibility on you, you know? Or like, yeah, you want to still have fun, but at the same time, you realize that like people are also watching, and like, you know, if you're not going to be like some dead mouse figure or something like that's just like kind of a iconic cartoon character up there on stage, and if you're going to be yourself and be somebody that people can relate to, you know, and be somebody that people can like give them something to hope for more than just an escape next weekend.
That's an exclusive from Even If It Isn't Right, the new album from Michael Mennert, out April 24th on PLM.
Well, your fans are tearing their hair out at this point that I've been wasting your time and not talking about the big news that actually came down today, a couple of hours ago as we're recording this. You announced a new album is coming out very, very soon. Even If It Isn't Right.
That's
Let's
right.
hear about it.
Basically, after my album, my first album was done, while I was working on my album, my father passed away. And that was part of the whole dreaming of a bigger life thing, was just dealing with watching somebody that I really looked up to and that I was there for, like, during the last moments of his life, kind of fade from this earth and just dream, and, like, me just having this dream of a life that was different than that and bigger than, like, the pain and the suffering that, you know, you see somebody you love experience through just existing. And so, you know, like, that album was heavily driven by, like, a wave of emotions that I couldn't help but just, you know, be taken back by. And I wanted the next piece to be equally as emotive or just as, like, expressive as that. And, you know, through the course of the last year and a half or 2 years, I mean, it took me about a year to make the album after I finished my first one. It just took about another, you know, 6 months or so after that to fine-tune everything, go through the paperwork and yada yada. But, But yeah, I mean, I 6 months after my first album, I had another album ready. It was just, it wasn't the album I wanted, you know? It had 16 or 17 tracks that were, like, good enough to put out and people would have liked. But to me, like you were saying, you know, it's like you realize that you have control over what you put out and you can do something that has a little bit more meaning to it or a little bit more kind of a purpose. And that's what I wanted to do. And so I kept kind of adding to it, subtracting certain songs, expanding certain songs into longer sections and, you know, building them into more like epic kind of movements and then taking some of the songs and trimming them down and just making it all fit together into like a piece of this big puzzle, you know? And in the meantime, you know, I was dealing with like the loss of my father, you know, a huge change in my life from having worked at Walmart to then all of a sudden touring and playing in front of people and, you know, being out of the house and being in the electronic scene after I hadn't really been in it 2 or 3 years, you know? And just seeing... Uh-huh. This whole new world, and it was like I was making a lot of choices, you know, like I was falling in and out of love with things that that I didn't really know the consequences of, and it was just like, that's where the title comes from, is even if it isn't right, it's kind of like you make those choices and they get you where you are, even if they're not right, you know. And I think like even just the length of my album being an hour and 41 minutes, it's like, even if that's not right, that's what my album is, you know. Even if it's 27 tracks, and even if only like 10 of those are danceable, the rest of it is what I feel like putting out. And it allowed me to kind of have an album that had the balance between, you know, just having a 6-song EP or 8-song EP of like bangers that you're going to play out at shows, and also having the songs that I want to listen to when I'm just chilling out, you know, like something somebody can roll one up to, or just, you know, go out and take a mountain drive in Colorado to, or, you know, go sit by the beach somewhere, you know, or whatever, just like music that you can, but also just live your life by, kind of, you know. And so,
and that seems to be the business model of Pretty Lights Music, that you stray away from the single format that 99% of dance music falls into. You take the time to focus on these bigger concepts and schemes. I mean, Grammatic put out a double album last year. I mean, you look at that and you say, you know, you can take the time to put out a great body of work, something that you can stand behind and say, yes, this is my artistic vision.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like also, like, when I first hit the scene, you know, after shows, we're like, man, that's great. Like, it sounds like you're biting Pretty Lights. And, you know, like, and I just got tired of explaining to people. And then, you know, the other half of people wanted me to go filthy and womp it out, you know? And, like, that's kind of died down lately. I think people kind of gotten over just being about that part of music, you know? But, like, it was just kind of like, I felt like a lot of what I was doing, you know, inside the musical world was subconsciously influenced by like these like negative elements of touring, you know, which is people want to hear dubstep. And I had to get put on these lineups where it'd be like, you know, 15 dubstep artists on a festival that like all were playing, you know, bass canon and stuff like that. And then me playing all originals. And of course, it's not going to sound as like familiar or as hard as everything else. And so it's just, you know, like a lot of it just kind of questioning yourself and thinking like, man, should I change paths? And, you know, like I was holding back a lot because I wanted to wait till people kind of got it before I tried to release something else, because I wanted it to be able to have its full potential of reach and just of affecting people the same way that the music that I make affects me, or the music that I love affects me. You know, a year ago when the album was just starting to kind of fill out, like I was still kind of having these, not doubts, but just kind of like these little squabbles with myself about like, man, I mean, I know how to make dubstep. Should I just do what a lot of people are doing and just, you know, make a pop dubstep in it and call it drumstep? Or like, you know, should I just like stick to my guns? And I'm glad I did, because it was like, you know, a lot of the places I toured, I've toured like 4 or 5 times now. And, you know, the first time I was there, people were kind of standing around like, what's this? It sounds kind of like Pretty Lights. I don't really get it. The second time, people were starting to like bob their head. And by the third or fourth time, people were like going crazy at my shows. And I played, you know, a lot of the same songs in those sets, and just made me realize that it wasn't the songs that were weak or my musical vision, but rather just like, you know, people unfortunately need to have time to understand something, or just to realize that like, oh yeah, this actually is good because someone told me it was good on the internet, you know? not everyone's like that, but I mean, when you're in a room full of 1,000 people that want to just party and they've never heard of you before, chances are they want to party, and they're, you know, they're more interested in that than, you know, discovering some new artist.
Yeah. No, I feel you. I feel you. So I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this, but I hear rumors of a Michael Menner mixtape floating around.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I've been making music for a long time. I've been producing since like 98, 97-ish in high school. And back then, I mean, back then it was garbage. At least compared to what I'm doing now, it was just basically like sitting around with software, not really having, you know, any kind of guidance, anybody around doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And slowly, by like 2002, I was starting to make stuff that was, you know, that was releasable and good. And I was working mainly in the hip-hop world, instrumental hip-hop music. And, you know, through moving and through kind of finally organizing this stuff, I found hundreds of tracks that were just unreleased, just sitting there, that were supposed to be for so-and-so who was going to rap on it, or somebody was going to sing on it or something, you know? Or even just ones that were just cool sketches. And I felt, this is never going to go anywhere unless I just put it out for free and just, you know, don't make it an album, just make it like a mix. And I want to start doing that. I want to have a mixtape series of both lost and kind of stuff that didn't make it on albums nowadays, you know, of just my own stuff, because it's like, I mean, I feel like listening to it, and I feel like a lot of times I'll put it on, like, you know, on the tour bus after a show, and people will be like, man, what is this? This is great. And I'll be like, oh, this is a track I made in 2004, you know? And
yeah.
Like, man, you should put this out. So, you know, and I feel like with the anticipation for my album and it kind of getting pushed back a few times, giving something else, like a little bonus away for free, isn't going to hurt, you know?
No, not at all.
Especially if it's not an official album, if it's not like, I don't feel like, I feel like people are going to understand with, you know, the way I'm trying to release it and just explain that this is kind of 2002 to 2006 stuff that I made that, you know, had a time and place then and may not be exactly what people expect from me now, but it's still part of my heart and it's something that I want to give out for free.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, Bicycle Day, 419. You get to meet back up with your buddies in Euphonic Conception, who threw the party in Denver and go big in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm so excited to be, like, headlining an event like that and being able to, like, work alongside, you know, the amazing Alex Gray and Mars One, who's, like, an amazing graffiti artist, follows him a long time. I've been a huge follower of graffiti, and I've even dabbled in it here and over in Europe. And just being able to be a part of, like, an artistic and creative event that's kind of, like, around bicycles, because, I mean, who doesn't love bicycles?
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, you know, like, I'm really excited about that. I mean, San Francisco is a great city. It's a great scene. It's one of those places in the country that just kind of, like, hasn't been struck with the same kind of gloom as a lot of other places have, you know?
Like,
I feel like the culture there, whether you want to call it, like, the deadhead hippie culture or whatever, it's like there's a part of the American dream that's still alive there that I feel like has kind of been sold in other parts of the country. And it's cool to go there. It's just a beautiful place. The lighting's wonderful. Like, the atmosphere is great. Just the vibe there, you know, I mean, I love it there, and I'm glad to be going back to, like, to do an event like that, where it's something that's really dope, alongside, like, Anastasia, DNA Beats, and Derek Van Scoten, and a bunch of people.
And so, I imagine, you know, as far as people kind of standing around and maybe bobbing their head at first when they heard your music, I'm sure the people of San Francisco got it from day one.
Oh, yeah, I mean, like, the first show I did in San Francisco, like, I was super blessed. I played at Temple, which is a great place, and played with DNA Beats and Blockhead for like, EC's first night there. They were doing it monthly, and they just, you know, like, people were really receptive to it. I had a blast. I had a great time slot. And, I mean, basically, it was an awesome night. You know, like, people there were just really inviting to me. And, you know, I got to meet a lot of friends there, stay with some friends out there. And it was just kind of like, you know, one of those times where you go to a town for the first time. I've been there before with different groups and stuff like that. But, like, going there as the first time as a new act and just getting the love that you feel, like, man, that's overwhelming. I'm so blessed to be doing what I do.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you got a lot of irons in the fire. Michael Mennert, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the UNS podcast.
Man, it's my honor. Thank you so much. This is dope. You guys have been at it when I first heard about you. You guys haven't stopped or slowed down or anything.
That's going to do it for today's show. Special thanks go to Kai with Vela Collective and, of course, my guest, Michael Mennert. His new album, Even If It Isn't Right, will be out on April 24th from Pretty Lights Music. You can catch him at Bicycle Day presented by Euphonic Conceptions and Symbiosis on April 19th at 1015 Folsom in San Francisco with a ton of special guests. The UNS Challenge 3 is coming to a close. You have until April 27th to vote for your favorite track. The winner will have a chance to DJ at Summer Camp, Wakarusa, Sonic Bloom, and Electric Forest Festival. Details at theUNS.com/theUNSChallenge3. That's 3 in Roman numerals. III. We've also got a ton of tickets to give away as well. Visit theUNS.com/contest for a chance to win festival passes to Camp Bisco 11, Summer Camp, Wakarusa, Sonic Bloom, Mint Green Festival, Altitude Boulder, I Love This City, and the Manifestation Celebration. Visit theUNS.com/contest to get on board. Please visit theUNS.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theUNS.com. Join the conversation at the UNS podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.